Welcome to Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. I'm Kate Burdett. Coming up, they're a common ailment this time of the year, seasonal allergies. We'll learn more about how to deal with the sniffling and sneezing. Jay Fox will also speak with experts about threats to Ohio's ash timber and the Ohio impact of recent EPA rollbacks. Plus, Doug Petcash of Face the State will have a look at state politics. First up on Columbus Perspective.
1 in 4 Columbus residents suffer from seasonal allergies. It starts in the spring as blossoms bring new foliage. Oak, maple, and birch trees peak in the spring here in central Ohio, with oak causing the most pollen here. As a result, Buckeyes are dealing with watery eyes, sneezing, and other bothersome symptoms. Doug Schroer, a primary care nurse practitioner for American Health Network based here in central Ohio, joins us on Columbus Perspective to talk about ways we can all breathe easier this spring. Welcome back, Doug. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me. How are you?
It's always a pleasure. I'm not sneezing. That's the good news.
Yes. This spring has already been exceptionally challenging. Now, right now, I'm sitting here with my tissues. Despite taking all of my allergy medication, it's still not always effective enough to treat the allergies in Ohio.
All right. Well, let's jump into it. What are the most common causes and symptoms of seasonal allergies?
Well, causes you already kind of briefly mentioned, talking about the different trees. Pollen's one of the most common allergens, which can come from trees, grasses, and other plants as they kick off their growing season. Unfortunately, while the warm weather is enjoyable, often that can bring about mold as well, which can be irritating. And as we eventually hit a dry season, sometimes then that kicks up a lot of dust as well, which can be aggravating for allergies too. As far as symptoms, the most classic symptoms are your itchy, watery eyes, runny nose, congestion, sneezing. And for people with asthma, that can trigger asthma attacks as well.
Now, what happens when we cut the grass? Does that cause a problem?
Not for everyone, but for many people with allergies, cutting grass can help to release more allergens into the air, and being in such close contact, especially with how a lawnmower works, that's kind of just projecting them into the air. So we're constantly kind of breathing a higher level of allergens while doing that.
I know as a parent, the minute the weather breaks, the kids want to get outside. So what should parents watch for in their children if their children suffer from allergies?
Long sleeves and pants can help, which is obviously difficult the warmer it gets. Having them change when they come in, a lot of the times the pollen and different allergens will, as they're playing on a playground or just out in the grass or dirt, that will kind of get on their clothes. So kind of having them immediately wash hands if they're going to be bathing that day, having them just go ahead and hop in the shower or bath, or at least changing their clothes when they're coming inside. And then when they're outside, trying to remind them not to touch their eyes or their face while they're outside, just because that tends to create more of the eye symptoms if they're rubbing their eyes with their hands that are covered in those allergens.
So when we talk about preventative measures, are we talking about just staying inside, or are there things that we can do that allow us to, A, go outside and enjoy the weather, and B, treatments that we can take either before or after we are outside?
So medications are, have been around for decades and are well tested and tried. Now, obviously, every person's health history is unique to them, so they should speak to their primary care provider or pediatrician about what's right for them. But in general, there are a lot of non-drowsy antihistamines that can be taken preventatively. Some of those include your Claritin or the generic Loratadine, Zyrtec, Allegra, again, or the generics. As well as in the recent years, the over-the-counter nasal steroids. Many people have probably seen commercials for Flonase or Fluticasone, Nasacort, Triamcinolone, and those are very effective. Some people use them year-round just preventatively, and some people just use them seasonally. But some of those medications, again, dose-dependent and dependent on the health history, can be used as young as the age of 2. So there are treatment options even for the very little ones, for pregnant women, all the way through older adults. There are over-the-counter allergy medications that are potentially an option.
Now, you had said just a minute ago that some people take their allergy medication year-round. I'm one of those people, but it's because I'm an asthmatic. When should normal people start allergy medication?
There isn't a year to year is not a universal time to start that, just because, as you know, in Ohio, it could be 80 degrees in January and then it could be, you know, 20 to below. But historically, I would typically say in early March, a couple weeks before you're anticipating the first time you're going to have to cut the grass, when you're first starting to see things potentially bloom or it's warming up. A couple weeks before that, to get ahead of it is usually what I would recommend.
Is it possible to over-medicate? And if so, how do you do that and what are the risks?
Over-medicating, I mean, if you're following the directions on the packaging, those by default are going to be more conservative. So you're not necessarily going to overdose taking what's prescribed there. But if you take too much different types of allergy medication, it can make you very dry, which for some people, they may prefer that, but as far as harm to their health, it can make the nose so dry that it can cause a bloody nose or just cause some irritation in the throat that may make you cough, which is typically easily correctable by either stopping the medication or, you know, adding the humidifier. But really, those are kind of the two main things, is the throat irritation and the extreme dryness tend to be the one way to know that you're overdoing it with the allergy medication.
Have you heard of any new medications in development that we should be aware of?
It's becoming more popular to combine a number of the different nasal sprays. So, as I mentioned, there's the nasal steroids. There is actually antihistamine nasal sprays. One's called Astapro. And then there's actually anticholinergic nasal sprays. Atrovent's a common one. And so now it's quite annoying to potentially carry three different nasal sprays and then to spray your nose three times. And so a number of companies have started combining these to make it more convenient for dosing and for carrying it around. And I've found those personally to be the most effective for me.
All right. So for the folks that have listened, where can we send them for more information about the subject?
I'll frequently have patients reaching out to me on, we use Epic in my chart. I have patients messaging me all the time just asking, and I appreciate this. They'll just say, hey, I'm having allergy symptoms. What, you know my health history. What do you recommend for me? Or, hey, I've been using this. Is this safe for me to continue? So I think just, you know, I think a lot of primary care would be fine just having you message or reach out to double check, you know, that there's no interactions and it's safe, but just asking what's best for me, and then being, you know, going out and getting it from the store and seeing if that does work for you.
How's the Kleenex working for you, Doug?
For the last 5 minutes, good. But, I mean, I it's at least a box a week right now, and that's just been the case for me for most of my life. So I'm a year-round person as well, not because of my asthma, but just because of how more severe my allergies are.
Well, we will suffer together, my friend. I want to thank Doug Shore for being with us, and for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
You're listening to Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's Jay Fox.
Central Ohio is plagued by invasive species or hungry pests that threaten the health of our crops and trees. Now, if left unchecked, they could devastate our agricultural industries, eliminate our jobs, threaten our food supply, and cost us billions of dollars in damages. There are some simple actions that people can take to protect agriculture, forests, and native ecosystems. Our friend David Grishow, who is the USDA Assistant National Policy Manager with APHIS Plant Protection and Quarantine, is joining us now on Columbus Perspective. Good morning.
Thanks for having me on your show today.
Well, we're going to talk specifically about the emerald ash borer. Where did this pest come from?
It was introduced in Michigan initially. It came from Asia. It was likely transported here in solid wood packing material.
This came in a shipping container?
Yeah, typically like pallets, wooden pallets that would be supporting a product that's in a shipping container.
So what kind of devastation is the emerald ash borer bringing to Central Ohio?
Well, it's impacting ash trees, all different species of ash trees. Some of the damage that it causes, it's a small D-shaped exit hole that's very visible to people that may be looking, as well as a woodpecker damage on a tree that is heavily infested, so people can look for those types of signs. But yeah, it's ultimately impacting trees, both forest and city and, you know, city trees, park trees, street trees.
So why does it like ash trees, and how many of them have been impacted?
It's just that particular species has evolved and adapted to ash, similar ash species over in Asia. And it's spread pretty far since its introduction, and so it's quite widespread throughout Ohio at this point.
So, what is the value of ash timber in Ohio, and what is the impact of these menaces on the industry?
Various invasive pests damage all different types of crops and trees, and ultimately these lead to expensive control efforts. Farmers, businesses, and communities must spend money to manage these infestations. So the combined impact can add up to an estimated $40 billion annually.
And what about the lost landscape economic value? I mean, these are beautiful trees.
Oh, yeah, of course. We all like spending time, outdoors. Weather is starting to get nice now this time of year, spring. Again, loss of street trees, park trees, that impacts loss of your shade. There's benefits of trees for your home, providing cooling in the summertime. So, yes, definitely a large concern.
I remember back in the 70s as a child, we lost tons and tons of elm trees in Northeast Ohio and Shaker Heights to something called Dutch elm disease. And spraying didn't save the trees, so they had to chop them down and replant with other types of trees. Is that what we're experiencing here?
Not so much with emerald ash borer. Eventually it will kill a tree. But depending on the species, like Asian longhorn beetle, yes, most likely the tree would have to be removed. Ultimately, over time, the tree will end up dying from the infestation. The beetles, whatever they are, will continue to reproduce. As much as that's not a great thing to hear about removing trees, ultimately we're trying to prevent that beetle from continuing to spread and impact more and more forest and becoming a larger issue.
Are other states having these kind of problems, or is this just an Ohio problem?
Oh, no. Right now, Asian longhorn beetle, for example, is located in Ohio, in New York, in South Carolina, and Massachusetts. Emerald ash borer is all throughout the Midwest and in the eastern states. So, and those are just, again, some of the forest pests. Fruit flies, for example, another invasive species that are typically something that are in the warmer parts of the country, California, Florida, those impact citrus and our vegetable crops.
So here's the billion-dollar question. David, what do we do about this?
So if your listeners spot an invasive species, early reporting can help stop pests before they spread. If you can take a photo, capture the pest, note the location, and then report the pest right away to your state agriculture department or to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And they can do this by going through the hungrypests.com website.
Now, is that where, if we go to hungrypests.com, will we be able to see pictures and get descriptions so we know what we're looking for?
Absolutely. It's a great resource. I encourage people to bookmark it. There's photos of various pests, information about them. And again, you can also select the state that you're located in to help narrow it down and give you local information. And you can also check state agriculture department websites for more information.
All right. We want to thank David Grushow for being with us. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's more from Jay Fox.
In February, the EPA officially rescinded its own 2009 endangerment finding that climate change poses a risk to human health and welfare. These policy shifts erode established Clean Air Act standards. And here in Central Ohio, we've had our first unhealthy ozone air pollution day in over a decade last year. Dr. Vijay Limaye is a climate and health scientist at the Natural Resources Defense Council, and he joins us now on Columbus Perspective. Good morning.
Good morning, Jay.
What do these new standards, the changes, mean for us here in Central Ohio?
This is really key that we realize that these changes at EPA, these rollbacks, are really essentially tied to our health and well-being. We all rely on clean, healthy air to live long, healthy lives. Those ozone alert days you mentioned are just one symptom of the types of problems that are going to get worse if we allow these rollbacks at EPA and the Clean Air Act to proceed.
What constitutes an unhealthy ozone air pollution day, and how does it affect us?
Yeah, so the Clean Air Act sets basically limits on the amount of pollution that's allowed outside in the air that we all breathe. EPA looks at six kind of top offenders when it comes to air pollution. Ozone is one of them. Ozone is an air pollution problem that's afflicting many parts of the country. More than 100 million people across the U.S. live in areas that exceed these health-based standards limits for ozone. Ozone is really an important health concern because it can exacerbate lung conditions, including asthma exacerbations. It can increase your likelihood of complications from lung infection. And it's a problem that's getting worse because of climate change. We know that the fossil fuel pollution that's out there in the air tends to form ozone in the atmosphere more readily when it's warmer outside. And in Ohio, we've seen temperatures increase measurably over recent years. So that's going to be a problem if we, allow these rollbacks to proceed, because it means more unhealthy air days and more health problems showing up in urgent care clinics, emergency rooms, and hospitals.
Now, here in the capital city, we were feeling pretty good about ourselves. We used to say, you know what, pollution, that's a Cleveland problem. They're the ones with poor air quality. However, the governor was up there just the first or second week of April announcing that Cleveland had passed an EPA clean air test. My question to you was that based on the old standard or the new standard?
I'll have to check, but probably, the thing we've seen with the ozone standard, for example, is a lot of delay from the folks in D.C. There's been clear rationale from the health side. I look at a lot of the health science these days, and there's a clear rationale for kind of tightening our limits on ozone pollution. We haven't done so in quite a while. So even while the air may be making the grade under some benchmarks these days, we really need to be vigilant, because the problem is poised to get a whole lot worse in the coming years.
Now, when we talk about climate change, the general public believes that climate change means it's getting warmer. And then when we have a string of 20 below zero days in January like we've never seen before, they say, no climate change.
Right.
That's not correct. How do we correct that misconception?
Yeah, it's a great question. It comes up a lot. I think here we need to think about the long term. I often kind of consider the difference between weather and climate as a difference between someone's mood, which changes day to day, hour to hour, minute to minute, and their personality, which is much more stable over the long term, hopefully. When it comes to climate, we pay attention to the long-term trends. And in Ohio, southeastern Ohio, we've seen clear evidence of warming over the long term. Since 1970, the average spring temperatures across the state have gotten about 3 degrees Fahrenheit warmer. The state is also getting considerably wetter when we look at all the data going back several decades. 45% increase in the heaviest rain events across the Midwest since the late 1950s. So warmer and wetter conditions in Ohio are something that we're seeing across the Midwest, and that has very real implications for the health and well-being of your listeners. We're talking about, increases in pollen seasons, right? A longer allergy season, heavier downpours that can increase flooding risks, more days that mosquitoes are a problem, even changes in how likely we're going to see these intense rainfall events. So these are all kind of different pieces of evidence that point to the one underlying climate problem in Ohio.
One of our staff meteorologists also added that we would be seeing more extremes. So hotter hot, colder cold, more intense rainfall, more intense snowfall, more intense wind, greater risk of tornadoes. Does that jive with what you're saying?
It does. Climate change generally means weirder weather, and it's harder to predict where and when these extreme events are going to happen, but the data are clear that we're going to see more of them happening generally. So the assumptions, you know, that when you think of farmers, when you think of business, you know, leaders, the assumptions and the weather conditions that we've had in the past just aren't going to hold into the future as climate change continues to unfold. So we have a lot of work to do to limit the damage from climate change through these Clean Air Act decision-making processes in D.C., but there's a whole lot we need to do to also get ready for these climate extremes that are increasingly heading our way.
Activists in Ohio have been protesting, saying that science is being ignored over economics. Do you believe that's accurate?
Yeah, unfortunately, we've seen that the folks in charge of the Environmental Protection Agency under President Trump have actually lately decided to even quantify the human health-related economic damage from air pollution. This is something they've been doing since 1981. It's a really radical move because it basically flips all the cost-benefit math, which is clearly in favor of air pollution and climate control, into a sort of upside-down situation in which we're only considering the costs to polluters to clean up their act. So economically, we know that cleaner, healthier air is a huge win for workers, for businesses, for insurers, public and private sector. But that math is now being completely sidelined and ignored by folks at the EPA.
Is there anything we can do to clean up our air and delay the impacts of climate change, or have we just missed the boat and it's too late?
No, there's certainly time. We need to be thinking about how to build an energy system that doesn't make us unhealthy and doesn't bake in more and more of these extreme events that are really dangerous across the country and especially in the Midwest. The number one thing we can do is transition more rapidly and readily towards clean and renewable energy sources that are cheaper than coal, more readily implementable than coal, and are really win the economic argument right now. So we're talking about expansion of solar and wind and a transition away from burning coal, oil, and fossil gas, which are contributing to day-to-day air pollution and health problems, but also contributing to long-term climate risk.
There's a lot of confusion in the information that is publicly available, with each side literally promoting itself to an extreme and causing folks to be distrustful, if you will, about what the truth is. That being said, is there a middle-of-the-road source for just plain information that the listener can interpret themselves without being swayed in one direction or another?
Yeah, you know, sure. I'd say as a scientist, the folks in charge in D.C. have really distorted the state of the evidence. Climate science is settled universally, globally. It's only the folks in charge of our Environmental Protection Agency that find themselves in this radical position. In Ohio, public polling shows that more than 60% of people are concerned about climate change, but they think many fewer of their neighbors are. So we need to be talking more about the problem and looking at, like you said, neutral data. One source I can recommend, people can Google Climate Central, which is an organization that basically just presents the data. It doesn't make any kind of claims about it, just shows you what's happening in Ohio and the Midwest, across the country and around the world. So all the temperature trends, precipitation trends, pollen season, ozone season, all that data is right there for folks to look at and make decisions on their own. But I'll say, as someone who's looked at the data for more than a decade, it's very clear where we're headed, what the problem is, and what the solutions are.
All right. We want to thank Dr. Vijay Lamaye for being with us today and explaining and unpacking some of this. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
Columbus Perspective is a public affairs presentation of WBNS Radio. The opinions expressed on this program are those of its guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WBNS Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors.
The Fan.
You're listening to Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Now, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10TV, here's Doug Petcash from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10TV.
People over 50 years old wield enormous economic clout in Ohio. The new Longevity Economy Outlook report from AARP shows in 2024, 50-plus residents made up 38% of Ohio's population, but accounted for 44% of the state's gross domestic product. And that percentage is projected to grow in the coming decades. But is that necessarily a good thing for the state? Well, adjusted for inflation, the figures look like this. Older Ohioans contributed $411 billion to the state's GDP in 2024. That's expected to rise to $696 billion in 2060, up to 46% of the total impact. Those over 50 paid $28 billion in taxes in 2024 and are projected to pay $52 billion in 2060. A couple other categories now. In 2024, Ohioans over 50 held 3.2 million or 45% of all jobs in the state. In 2060, that's projected to go up to 47% or 3.6 million jobs. And older Ohioans made 48% of all wages and salaries in 2024 and are expected to make 49% in 2060, $420 billion worth. Joining me to talk about the implications of this is AARP Ohio State Director Jenny Carlson. Jenny, thanks for being here today.
Well, thank you for having me.
So what was the purpose, or what is the purpose of the study?
The purpose of the study is to show the stronghold of the 50-plus workers. We are contributing over $411 billion to the economy. We are the economic engine. We are individuals who are working, providing support to businesses, providing support to communities, providing care across the state of Ohio. But it really is about contributions and readiness.
What do you mean by readiness?
Great question. So the data is rich. We've got individuals who are working, the stronghold for the economy. But public policymakers needs to understand some of the pressure points within the report. For example, caregivers. 2.2 million Ohioans are caregivers across the state of Ohio. 93% of them are using their own money to contribute and support their caregiving roles. That's $33 billion worth of care gone unchecked, providing support of what, you know, for the most part, is a very pressured healthcare system. So you've got to take a look at some of the pressure points within the report. There's a lot of great information. Economic stability, aging workforce, but we are working longer. We are providing stable assistance within the local economy. We're supporting services. We're supporting businesses. We're providing volunteer work. Mm-hmm. But
is working longer a choice or is it by necessity now?
It's both.
Okay.
You know, individuals are living longer. Individuals want to thrive, stay in the workforce. There's a lot of value for an older worker in the workforce in that you've got stability, you've got longevity, you've got
experience,
of course. You've got that management level. And there certainly are workforce challenges, mm-hmm. and that's where older workers need to be front and center in any public policy debate.
So why is the population of Ohio continuing to age? I noticed in the report that the number of 50-plus residents actually declined by a very small percentage, less than 1%, I think it was 0.6% or something like that. But it is projected to continue to be a growing segment of the population.
We have a growing segment, but we have to keep in mind that it is not a small population. It's not sidelined. It's front and center. Mm-hmm. It's contributing significantly to the economy. We're supporting businesses. We're paying taxes. We are providing care to loved ones. And so taking all that in combination, it really is important and it has to be contemplated when any public policy person looks at the data and determines what are the next steps.
And you talked about the pressure points. When somebody is getting older themselves, you know, I'm well into my 50s now and I don't feel old, of course.
Too.
But, you know, you start to think about many people who are also taking care of aging parents, but maybe also still, you know, caring for children as well. So when you look at those pressures on somebody, and is it some of them are having to work longer to be able to make those ends meet? Or what's the situation there?
So you've referenced what we call the sandwich generation, okay, in that we're providing care to individuals, loved ones that are younger, as well as individuals that are older. And when we talk about care, it could be a spouse, it could be a relative, it could be a community member. And so people are making hard decisions on how to provide that care. And some of the data, I mean, it's rich data. I would encourage everyone to look at it, in that individuals are making tough decisions. There's that emotional toll that if you don't keep that in check, especially employers, you have to pay attention to this, that individuals are making tough decisions around what do I do in the workforce and how do I manage the care. And then you have the pressure points of how am I keeping myself healthy,
yeah,
right? And then
with caregivers, you hear that a lot.
Yeah,
you have to take care of yourself first.
You do, and you need that respite care, mm-hmm. and that's so important. And then you also have that financial pressure, too. And so on average, 93% of the individuals are using their own savings to provide care. Mm-hmm. And so we're seeing pressures on, you know, savings are going down the drain. People aren't paying their bills. They're making tough decisions because of that caregiving role. Mm-hmm. And so you've got that pressure point, and it truly is at a breaking point, where individuals are providing care. There could be instability mm-hmm. in their finances with regard to working. If there's challenges there, there could be loss of productivity. And so then taken all together, the pressure is making hard decisions as a caregiver. So providing care at home, people want to age in place.
Yeah.
People want to stay in their communities.
So what does AARP advocate for in that sense then?
So what we're advocating for is acknowledgement of individuals providing that care, $33 billion annually.
And
unpaid care. We also have to make sure that, you know, 6 out of 10 individuals in this survey, in this research, are working individuals. 1 out of 4 Ohioans are working and providing care. And a lot of times, it's care, they're working full-time, and then they have a full-time caregiving job. And that's hard. It's really hard. So we are advocating for common sense solutions.
Yeah, now I understand that you or someone from AARP testified in favor of the proposed caregiver tax credit.
We did.
Just what is that, and how do you believe that it would help?
So it's recognition of the out-of-pocket expenses. And when you become a caregiver, generally speaking, it's unplanned, right? And so the average amount caregivers are spending is about $7,200 annually. But if you're providing care longer, I mean, just imagine that that's unplanned care and that's a drain on your financial resources. And then if you have a loved one that needs care where their acuity level is worsening,
yeah,
you know, like memory care, for example, or individual, you know, a service member who has complex care needs, that requires a lot more pressure. And so that legislation acknowledges the fact that individuals are providing over $7,200 on average of out-of-pocket expenses. And it's a recognition that we want to support individuals. We want people to thrive, live in place, live in their communities. And it's a non-refundable tax credit. So if the person, your loved one that you're providing care to, has certain acuity needs, you can work with your provider, work with the individual to provide and take advantage of that non-refundable tax credit. Yes.
We're almost out of time. How can people get more information on the study if they're interested?
Oh, it's at AARP.org. Dive deep into the information. We want to work with the community. You know, AARP stands ready to help caregivers get the resources. We're spotting and watching fraud. We're helping with pocketbook issues. And we have strong voices at the State House and in Congress. And so we want people to stand up and join us on these advocacy initiatives.
Jenny Carlson with Ohio AARP. Thank you so much for your time and to break down this study.
Thank you.
Teachers are dynamic leaders, shaping a new generation. They bring a variety of perspectives from diverse backgrounds, innovating how they teach to prepare students for our fast-changing world. Achieving this takes skill and expertise. They're tireless explorers, creatively discovering a universe of solutions, telling stories, experimenting, inspiring, mentoring, connecting cultures, and connecting with each other. leading by example. Experience the unique joy of helping students thrive. Teaching is a journey that shapes lives. Are you ready to begin? Explore teaching at teach.org, a campaign supported by the U.S. Department of Education, teach.org, and 1 million teachers of color.
When you're high, you feel different. You think different, you talk different, you draw different, you listen to music different, but you probably knew that. Problem is, you also drive different, and not in a good way. That's why driving high is illegal everywhere. So if you're high, just don't drive. Make a plan to get a sober ride. Because if you feel different, you drive different. Brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Ohio has hit the brakes on handing out tax breaks for data centers. Governor Mike DeWine directed the Ohio Tax Credit Authority to pause consideration of new data center requests for tax exemptions. The pause went into effect after Monday's Tax Credit Authority meeting. The governor says it will stay in effect while a new joint committee of lawmakers looks at the growth of data centers in the state. The governor stresses this is not a ban on data centers. Ohio lost nearly $1.6 billion in tax revenue through those exemptions in 2025. Just before that pause took effect, the Tax Credit Authority approved a 50% tax exemption over the next 10 years for the company Cologix. Cologix announced plans for two new data center campuses in Orange Township and Johnstown. The company already operates four data centers in the region. Cologix says these projects represent a $1.1 billion investment. The centers will take years to build, and the company says they will create more than 90 direct jobs. There are roughly 200 data centers in Ohio, according to Data Center Map. More than 100 of those are in central Ohio. A brand new joint committee gathering information on data centers heard from the public during a more than four-hour hearing last week. More than 30 people testified in person. Many more submitted written testimony. One by one, people stepped up to the podium for their 5 minutes in front of the newly formed Joint Select Committee on Data Centers.
This is not a partisan issue. Water is not Republican or Democrat.
Some with concerns about water, others with air and noise pollution.
Noise pollution concerns can be partially addressed by the state also requiring data centers to use the best noise reduction mechanisms available.
Still others voiced concerns about transparency and non-disclosure agreements associated with data center projects.
Everyday Ohioans should not have to spend their evenings submitting records requests and digging through utility filings just to understand what is happening around their homes.
Monday's testimony comes several days after Governor Mike DeWine directed the Ohio Tax Credit Authority to pause consideration of any new data center sales tax exemption requests. Signal Ohio had reported and 10TV confirmed Ohio lost nearly $1.6 billion in tax revenue through the exemptions in 2025. Still, several people at this hearing want lawmakers to hit the brakes on new data centers while studying the issue.
Asking you to please push pause with a statewide moratorium because there are too many unanswered questions, and that's why we're here.
The Data Center Coalition, a data center industry organization, says data centers have contributed nearly $10 billion to Ohio's GDP and more than $930 million in state and local taxes since 2023. Dan DiIorio, the coalition's vice president of state policy, said in an April statement that a statewide moratorium on data centers would discourage further investment, undermine Ohio's economic momentum, and signal that Ohio is closed for business. Meanwhile, a grassroots group continues its push for a constitutional amendment to ban large-scale data center projects. Several members of Conserve Ohio testified before the Joint Select Committee on Data Centers. Volunteers with the group are now collecting signatures to try to put a constitutional amendment on the ballot to ban large data centers. They need more than 413,000 valid voter signatures by July 1st to get the proposed amendment on the November ballot. According to their website, they have more than 40,000 right now, but they say they have many more that have not yet been counted. So if they don't collect enough signatures to put the proposed constitutional amendment on the November ballot, they say they will continue their efforts for an election beyond that. Also at the State House, the Ohio State Senate voted unanimously to pass the $3.7 billion capital budget. The budget would fund construction and maintenance projects across the state over the next 2 years. Highlights of the plan include $600 million for school facilities, $425 million for higher education institutions, $265 million for the Department of Natural Resources, and $200 million for community projects such as sports fields, parks, theaters, and museums. The budget would also provide more than $22 million for projects in Franklin County. Those include improvements at the Great Southern Metro Park, Life Care Alliance, the Franklin Park Conservatory, and the Central Ohio Fire Museum.
This bill is especially meaningful in recognizing that strong communities require more than roads and bridges. They require places where people can learn, create, heal, recover, gather, and thrive.
And the capital budget now goes to the House. In the Ohio House, lawmakers unanimously passed a bill aimed at protecting people's SNAP benefits by making it harder to steal those benefits. It's called the Enhanced Cybersecurity for SNAP Act. If passed, House Bill 163 would replace all existing EBT transfer cards with cards that are chip-enabled, making it harder for scammers to steal your card data. The bill now heads to the state Senate.
Again, that's courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV. From the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV. This has been Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. Heard each Sunday morning at 6 on WBNS FM 97.1 The Fan and on 1460 AM The Fan 2.